The Point Forward Podcast, Milwaukee Bucks chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. Got another special episode for you, and I know, I think I promised on the last one we would talk more about the current Bucks team. They're coming off of a very bad loss against a very bad Houston Rockets team on Thursday night. Kevin Porter Jr. for 50 points, really? And on top of that, Giannis Antetokounmpo came in with a bulky ankle and left with what looked like a worse one. He sprained his ankle, left early in the game, did not return. It was part of a horrible night for Wisconsin sports fans. It's the same day that it was reported Aaron Rodgers wants out of Green Bay, a huge fiasco on the night of the NFL draft. If you're a Milwaukee Brewers fan, their outstanding pitcher Corbin Burns went on the injured list with mysterious circumstances. Appears to be a COVID-19 diagnosis. We don't know that for sure, but just a really, really bad day for Wisconsin sports fans. And certainly Giannis getting hurt adds to it. I think on the last podcast mentioned that we would talk more about the current Bucks team. We will still do that early next week with Jim Ozarski, Bucks beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But you know what? Let's just take a break. Let's take a break from the current climate. And I wanted to, once again, to go back in time. Monday, you heard from Lori Nickel describing the scene in Milwaukee when the Milwaukee Bucks first came to the city and kind of what it took to bring them here. Again, we have been commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Milwaukee Bucks championship back in 1971. We have arrived at the 50-year mark exactly at this point when they beat the Baltimore Bullets, swept them in the NBA Finals 4-0. Gosh, it was so easy for that 1971 team. It's kind of hard to believe that the franchise has not won a title. It's only been back to the finals once in the half century since then. This is obviously a year where Bucks fans hope that changes, but it doesn't help when Giannis is leaving games with injuries, and the Bucks are struggling to beat teams like the Houston Rockets. Milwaukee still really set in that number 3 seed. That is almost certainly where we're headed, folks. They're going to clinch a playoff spot very soon. Obviously, the Nets are coming up. That's one of their direct competitors and possibly a team that they see in the forthcoming playoffs. So two very interesting games coming up at Pfizer Forum this next week. We will talk about it. I promise that Jim Ozarski and I will talk about it. But I wanted to share an interview that I really, really like looking back, put a bow on this coverage we've had at jsonline.com of that 1971 team. A look back at that with the voice of the Bucks then. Eddie Doucette, who is definitely a familiar voice for a lot of old-time Bucks fans. He was calling the team, calling every game back in the 70s for the radio when TV, you know, it wasn't so easy to see the Bucks on the television. There were only really a few games broadcast locally every year and just a couple nationally, but Eddie Doucette was the guy. He was on the radio call, and he's the guy who coined the phrase skyhook, the shot that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar made famous. He coined a ton of nicknames. He definitely was a colorful character, and he lives out in California today and is happy to talk about that 1971 Bucks team, looking back at the greatness that was that championship run. It's a great interview. Love talking to Eddie Doucette. Talked to him a couple years ago as well. I think you're really going to enjoy hearing from him. So again, if you get a chance, go to jsonline.com. Check out, Jim Ozarski has an oral history of that 1971 Bucks season. He talked to a lot of players. Ben Steele spoke with Oscar Robertson, of course, the great Oscar Robertson, acquired before that season from Cincinnati. He was the missing piece and really was a standout in the playoffs. I mean, he really took his game to another level for him to win his first championship with the Milwaukee Bucks, first and only championship in his career. So that's a really cool read. You know, Jim wrote about the fact that there was no parade for the Bucks after they won the 1971 championship and how kind of off-putting that is in retrospect, especially because we have had parades for other sports successes, both before and after, namely the Milwaukee Braves in 1957 and then the Milwaukee Brewers in 82 when they did not win the World Series. But the Bucks in 71 just did not get that same level of treatment. So you can read Jim Ozarski's story talking to some of the people who were around then about that. I really recommend that one in particular. I did a game-by-game look at all the games from the 71 season. A lot of legendary names and faces showing up there. A lot of great coaches, great players that faced off with the Bucks. I wrote about Kareem going up against Wilt Chamberlain all season long. The Lakers-Bucks matchup was definitely a matchup to watch and came to a head in the playoffs where the Bucks beat the Lakers to advance to the NBA Finals against the Bullets. There's a lot there. Lori Nichols' story about the city of Milwaukee at the time also at jsonline.com. So read all that stuff. It's really good. Especially the stuff I didn't write. I don't mean to say that my stuff is the best of the bunch. It definitely isn't. It's just great stuff from a great team of people over at the Journal Sentinel. So check that out. But in the meantime, here is my interview with the one and only, the incomparable Eddie Doucette, looking back at the 1971 Milwaukee Bucks championship. My guest is Eddie Doucette. Longtime Bucks fans will know him as the voice of the Milwaukee Bucks, TV and radio broadcaster for 16 years with the organization. He's co-founder of the Mac Fund. I think for a lot of people, just the voice of their childhood, the voice of their first Bucks memories. He's joining us to chat a little bit about the 1971 team. Thank you so much for joining us, Eddie. And before we get to 1971, I got an interesting question to throw your way from some of the later years. We call our podcast the Point Forward Podcast, and we discussed who the original point forward is. I think there's some thought it could be Paul Pressey, you know, under those Don Nelson teams. Or Marcus Johnson, even a little bit before that. And I know Marcus Johnson kind of lays claim to it, and he's around the Bucks a lot as a broadcaster. Who is the original point forward? Who would you identify as the original point forward in Bucks history?
I would identify that individual as Paul Pressey.
All right.
I think that was the intent of Don Nelson, the creator, was to try and make something special out of the unit that he had at that time, and Pressey fit that mode. So, yeah, no, I think it's Paul, although, you know, Marcus certainly had similar qualities, but I think Pressey really fit the mold of what Nelly was trying to achieve.
That is where my side of the argument was in favor of Paul Pressey. He's one of the first Bucks I remember. So that's kind of how I was looking at it. But Marcus Johnson, no disrespect, a great player as well, very beloved in Bucks history. So I'm going to rewind now a little bit to that 1971 season, 50 years ago when the Bucks won the lone championship in franchise history. We talked about this a couple years ago when I had you on, discussing how trying to set the scene a little bit for how the city embraced that team or what expectations the city had for that team. I know this is a fledgling NBA. The ABA is still in the equation. Two leagues instead of one, I imagine, is a difficult thing for modern fans to kind of grasp, to imagine that basketball was, you know, wasn't just one central league. You've got teams expanding left and right. The Milwaukee Bucks themselves are only 3 years old at this point. I know Kareem arriving had to have generated quite a bit of fan buzz in Milwaukee, but can you kind of illustrate what it was like, how the city of Milwaukee received this team, if they, you know, if they had Bucks fever the way that we would kind of have Bucks fever if they went to the NBA Finals here in 2021?
Well, don't forget now, this Milwaukee Bucks team was part of a league which was a whole lot smaller than it is now. We were a 16-team league at that particular point in time. And when this team came to Milwaukee, the feeling was, hey, and this is basically a quote from then-President Ray Patterson, we know high school, we know college, we know nothing about professional basketball. So the idea was to try and put people in the stands and create some excitement. And basically he told me if I didn't get the job done, I was gone in a year. So my, you know, I was vested with the task of trying to create some kind of interest, some kind of excitement in a community that I already knew was a great sports town, very understated, because they had the Packers, they had the Badgers, they had Marquette, they had baseball, Major League Baseball, even though it was on a bit of a hiatus at that time. I knew how good the fan was there, and I didn't have any really compunctions at all about trying to attack this in a different way, because I thought people would accept it, and I thought it was needed at the time. So we went out there, we did a series of speaking engagements. We really put ourselves out into the community to really get a temperature reading about how this team might be accepted, and found out that there was a lot of interest, a lot of excitement. And so my first thought was, because I was a young guy at the time, and I had been coming from a broadcasting community that was pretty much, you know, top 40 radio, and everything was zippity-doo-dah back then. So I just figured, hey, listen, let's do something a little bit different. We understand that the older people are going to be, you know, maybe a little question mark there, here and there, but the young people would be the reason that might really stir the pot and get people interested to the point where they get excited about the new team. So I went after the young demographic, and it proved to be the perfect storm and really turned into something very special. And we learned early on that this Milwaukee Bucks team was going to be received, as we saw in the very first year, 25 wins. The next year, 66. Or 56, and then it went on up to 66. And we knew that we had something that was special because we had Lou Alcindor, and then Oscar joined the team, and it was feverish in the community about these Milwaukee Bucks. So I don't think at that point in time, in our minds, there was any trepidation about how the team would be received or what kind of community involvement that they would have. We were off and rolling, and it was a great feeling.
I'll talk a little more about some of your the way you spice things up a little later. I think most fans know that you were sort of you coined the phrase "skyhook bango" is a name that comes back to your broadcasting. But the outset of this season, this 1970-71 season, you know, you mentioned Wisconsin at that point before the Bucks came to town. It's a college, it's a high school state. I don't even know how aware people were of Oscar Robertson, the guy that the Bucks traded for from Cincinnati. I'm sure they had heard of him. He was, you know, one of the best players in the game for years before he came to Milwaukee. But I don't know if there's an understanding, a grasp of what it means for the Bucks to have traded for somebody of his caliber. I mean, it was truly a blockbuster deal and you know, remembered in retrospect as one of the great moves in Wisconsin sports history. But do you remember the moments after that, how Milwaukee received that, if that suddenly makes it a championship or bust season? I mean, that would certainly seem to be the case when you get, you know, when you have two of the best players in basketball at that point.
Well, you have the chocolate cream pie, and then you have the whipped cream up on top. Oscar Robertson came in after we had Kareem, and we, at that time, he was still Lou Alcindor. But we were euphoric about the fact that we were able to get Lou Alcindor on the coin flip, and he decided between us and that fledgling ABA and came to Milwaukee. And then the word and the interest in pro basketball started to spread. It was a smaller base that was starting to spread throughout. People were starting to become followers of the game. And so by that point in time, people were really aware of who Oscar Robertson was. Now, I don't know that today there are a lot of people that realize how great a talent he was. And he's arguably in that that conversation about the greatest of all time at the point guard position because of playing both ends of the floor, understanding the game, being a leader, and understanding what it would take to get to the throne room. And that was getting to a place where you had the greatest center in the world and working in tandem with him. At that point in time, no, as an aside, unlike today, the game was an outside-in game. Today, it's an inside-out game where you're having the three-point shooters stretch the floor. But back then, if you had a top-notch point guard and a big man that could maneuver inside and get the job done, then you were sitting on top of the world. And so people were becoming educated. That was part of our job in the off-season, speaking all over the state, taking players around, doing the things we had to do to totally educate the Wisconsin sports fan as to the whys and the wherefores of the NBA and the game and the players involved. We were fortunate enough, as history will tell you, up to this point and from this point beyond, to have two of the greatest players to ever play in the game of basketball. So having Oscar Robertson come in there, and it was his choice, by the way. I mean, there were opportunities for him to go to L.A. or go to New York, his hometown. But he wanted, that was Kareem, but to go to New York to be with somebody from that city. But he chose to come to Milwaukee to play with the greatest, at that time, center in the game and the focal point of everybody's basketball conversation. What would this do to the game to have a third-year team evolved to the point where they were now a threat for the championship. And it kind of bore itself out from that point on. So people were aware. People were excited. There was a lot of conversation. You couldn't walk anywhere in the city and not have somebody approach you because he knew that you were involved with the team and want to talk about the Bucks. I was getting constant calls from school teachers and parents trying to figure out the lexicon that I used while doing the games. So we knew the interest was there. And now it was just our opportunity to put it together and capitalize at the situation. And as I said, it became the perfect storm.
I know there aren't a lot of games on TV at this juncture. And you said you're going all over the state. I'm sure some of the Bucks players did that as well. I'm sure people could tell when Lou Alcindor walked into a grocery store, you know, then Kareem was known as Lou Alcindor then. 7'2" guy, people are going to know who that is. Oscar Robertson, I imagine, still had some celebrity too. But are these guys, are their faces on billboards? Are they faces people know? Like, could the players go out in public without being, you know, sort of bombarded with autograph requests? Or was it a little bit different? You know, I imagine when the Bucks got Kareem, he's basically LeBron James or Zion Williamson. You know, it's the same level of fanfare. But right. Is it the same level of exposure? I suppose probably not quite as bad as it is today.
No, I think today it would be a whole lot different than it was back then. I mean, you know, our players could walk into George Webb and nobody would bother them at 2 in the morning if they wanted to get a sandwich or a dish of eggs. But I don't think today's players could get away with that in Milwaukee because they are all over the place. However, and we had limited resources at that time in order to really develop the personalities. And that was really my job. I had to figure out a way to develop personalities, thus the nicknames. And I had to try and develop a formula of creating a face through the words that I would use on the radio so people would know these people when they were in the community. And it was amazing how they absorbed these, the assimilation process for accepting and understanding who the Bucks were, and them becoming a part of the community was a very important thing. I think that, and this is why Milwaukee is indigenous unto itself, because I've said this many times, having worked in L.A., having worked in New York, Chicago, around the country, that Milwaukee is a great understated sports community. The state of Wisconsin, people love their sports. And the big thing about Milwaukee and Wisconsinites is they want to be a part of that family. They want to be able to say that they had an opportunity to shake Lou Alcindor's hands or to have Oscar Robertson come into their automobile showroom and sign autographs and talk to them for a while. That was a big deal back then. And that's kind of how we were able to develop the personalities, take it to a different level, and then spread out from there. It was a fanning out process that enabled us to develop the personalities as they were. And of course, because we had limited TV exposure, we did most of the things that we did were on radio. If people really wanted to know and follow the Bucks, they had to tune into radio. So WTMJ and our 36-station radio network, or whatever it was at the time, were really the conveyors of the word, the personalities, and the words I picture that we created of those individuals who played on that team. The Greyhound, Bobby Dandridge, Captain Marvel, Greg Smith, Johnny Mack, Rainbow Jumper, the King, Kareem, and the Big O, and these people. The Cement Mixer, Dick Cunningham. These were names that, you know, I got to be honest with you. A lot of what we did, we didn't really totally understand how we were doing it, but it kind of fell into place. And it was an opportunity for me as the broadcaster to be as inventive and creative as possible. Because remember, I had that one thing hanging over my head by Ray Patterson, who poked me in the chest and said, I'll give you 1 year to figure it out as to how you're going to put people in the stands and create excitement, or you're gone. That was it. I had to go all out and figure out a way, and we did, and it worked perfectly. At the time, it was what we had to do, and it happened.
the Milwaukee Arena selling out regularly to see this team during the 70-71 season. So yes, whatever you were doing was working. But also there were some games in Madison, and my understanding is the crowds there were also very, very good, but a very different situation from today. The Milwaukee Arena was not often available for the Bucks, even during the playoffs, the first round playoff series, which we can get to, but the first round of the playoff series against San Francisco had to be played in Madison because of the Milwaukee home show at the Milwaukee Arena. There were all sorts of trade shows that were frequently bumping the Bucks. You know, it's unheard of today, but it actually wasn't that unusual. Even you know, San Francisco in that same series had a similar problem. So what was it like going to Madison, what is now the Alliant Energy Center, I think? It was the Dane County Coliseum there. I'm not actually sure what it's called at the moment, but what were those games like? Did it bother the players that they didn't always have a Milwaukee venue to call home because they'd get bumped for certain stretches of the season?
Well, I got to interrupt one of your thoughts right there. Whatever the Dane County Coliseum, we got rid of that one in a hurry. From the point that we went out there through the playoffs, whenever we went out there, it was always the Great Dane.
Ah.
So we made a caricature out of the facility as well, and that was something I played on a lot. You know, here we are away from home at the Great Dane, and it was fun. But we made it fun, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Yeah, it's business. We hear all about it, the big contracts, this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I've often said that unlike those days when the players really had to earn their money, today the players are treated like milk-fed veal. Their feet never touch the ground. So it was like taking the circus on the road. You know, the carnival on the road. We were going to the Great Dane, and it was showtime. And the ringmaster was the PA announcer, and we had it all. You know, we had everything we could do to try and create images that were enticing to get fans to come to the game, to listen to the games, because we had a sponsor responsibility. And we figured, hey, listen, if we got a bad game, we're going to try everything we can to keep these fans listening to the game, because we want those sponsors that are in the last quarter to get more bang for their buck.
Mm-hmm.
So they were always, you're constantly thinking about ways to engage fans and keep them involved and make them part of the family. You don't really get that feeling today around the NBA or around sports. It's all big business, and I understand that. When you sign these kind of contracts like Giannis signed, or this kid in San Diego signed yesterday for $340 million. Come on now. It's a game. None of these guys have ever saved a life. It's a game. And so let's go out there and entertain. Because I want to tell you, the guy that works at Harnischweger, the guy that works at Alan Bradley, these guys work hard for their money. If they get through the day, they put in 8 hours. It's hard work. They want to come home, they want to listen, they want to be entertained. So you try and do that, you try and entertain them with the product you put on the floor, you try and make life better for them by giving them something that they can identify with, their team, their city, their home. And that's what we tried to do. We tried to create a personal relationship with the fans. I don't know that a lot of that is happening anymore. I think with a guy like Giannis in Milwaukee now, you got a good chance of doing it because he's really a good guy. I mean, he's a guy that'll reach out. With Kareem, Lou Alcindor, it was a little difficult because most people thought he was arrogant and standoffish. He really wasn't that way. He was more of a professional and treated this like his art form. But people didn't understand that. They still wanted to be a part of. So the Great Dane, the trips to Madison, and by the way, we had one series over there in Madison where the snow was so bad in Milwaukee, we didn't know if we were going to be able to make it there and had to go in and get, Kareem was living in a place in a home which was very close to, Blue Mountain Country Club. We had to go in there on a snowmobile to get him out of there, to get him to a bus, to get him to Madison.
And, no way.
No, dead serious. A lot of people don't even know that. But, yeah, I mean, that would never happen today. I mean, today they would get snowplows in there. They get helicopters in there for Giannis. I mean, they'd do everything they could to get the governor to get on and pick him up in a limo. That never happened then. I mean, it was what you had to do to get out there and let the lights shine and the show go on.
trying to picture this rescue mission, putting a 7-foot-2 guy on a snowmobile through the streets of Milwaukee to get him to the bus.
Well, out of there, I'm telling you, you can verify that story with anybody that would remember. I mean, there aren't many of us left, but yeah, no, that's the truth. And
awesome.
Yeah, it was, and everybody got a laugh out of it. You know, the Dandridges of the world who was a cut up anyway. Johnny Mack, of course, he's still around, and even Kareem would verify that. I mean, it was it was one of the many funny stories we had in our travels. Let's put it that way, either by airport, plane, buses, the Badger bus line, the bus trips down to Chicago. Many interesting trips for sure.
So you're talking about trying to make these games interesting no matter what. You go through the game by game, you'll see a lot of blowouts. The Bucks dominated the foe most nights. There were a couple close games here and there. You know, late in the year, the Bucks were kind of coasting into the playoffs, so those games really account for like most of the losses. What were there one or two moments during the regular season from this year that really stand out? You know, something that, I don't know, a close finish or these battles with the New York Knicks that were pretty spirited. I mean, maybe it's Kareem going up against Wilt Chamberlain. What resonates when you think of the 1971 regular season?
Well, I mean, I think of, you know, you talk about Kareem and Wilt Chamberlain. I'm looking at a picture in my office right now of a game I did. And you talk about greats. And I defy anybody to tell me that they could come up with something with a collection of greats like this. Going for a rebound, Kareem, Wilt behind him going up with his hand on Kareem, who's got the ball, and underneath Oscar Robertson and Jerry West.
Yes.
Now, how's that for a four-pack?
That is,
I mean,
not
you,
bad.
You tell me you can do better than that in today's game, and I'm telling you that you're out there with the ears rare. I don't see anything like that happening. These guys were the very best, and so night in and night out, that didn't always happen, but there were a lot of nights where I had those kind of matchups where you sat back and you said to yourself, man, now this is really something. I remember the series that we had in 74 against the Boston Celtics. There were six future Hall of Famers playing in that series. Six. And a couple of other guys that are on the fringe. So you can't really say that there is anything too much better than that. We had a lot of nights where we didn't have good games, and those are the nights where you had to really dig into the valise and come up with some material that you thought was engaging enough, entertaining enough to keep the crowd listening. But you know, the good thing about that team was people were so interested in that team. They were there whether we had good games or bad games. We didn't have many bad games. Remember, we won 20 games in a row for one stretch, lost a game, come back, win 14 in a row more. So that's a pretty good run. Now, that's not the NBA. The record for consecutive wins in the league is 33, and the Bucks broke that Laker record at the Milwaukee Arena on a cold January night the following year. But before that, it was Milwaukee with a 20-game winning streak, and that was toward the end of the season, and then we finished the regular season with 14 straight wins going into the playoffs, and then you know the story with the playoffs. So in any man's world, this was a very special team. And it wasn't just because we had Oscar and Kareem. We had Bob Dandridge. He averaged 18.4 points a game. And Oscar Robertson will tell you that we don't win without him. Kareem averaged 31.7 points a game, shot 58% from the floor, and was a top rebounder. And, you know, his rebound total was incredible. Oscar Robertson, in the twilight of a brilliant career, he ended up with, if I remember, 19.3 or 19.4 points a game. And John McLaughlin was right in there also. He averaged 16 points a game, 15.8. So this was a special collection of players. And you know what even made it even better? Let me tell you what. It was like the old baseball players who used to pitch 300 innings and go 30 complete games, which you don't see anymore. You see a guy that goes five innings, you got a middle guy, a setup guy, and a closer. It's all specialty. In today's NBA world, you see what's happening with Kevin Durant today and Kyrie Irving. These guys take every three nights, play three nights and take a couple nights off. In that team that we had, I remember specifically, Kareem Alexander played 82 games regular season. Bob Boozer, who was our first guy off the bench, 80 games, and he was at the end of his career. Now we're talking about longevity here. Dandridge, 79 of the 82 games. McLaughlin, 82 games. Greg Smith, 82 games. Oscar Robertson, at the end, 81 games that year. Now, you tell me where you can get that kind of performance over a period of games, the kind of travel we used to do, play late night games up on the first flight out of the city to get to the city the next day where we had to play, sometimes four games and six games, five games and 8 days, and have that kind of a performance. And you ask me about that, and I will tell you, the greatest measurement of superiority and outstanding excellence in whatever it is you do is consistency. Now, do these players that I just mentioned, were they consistent? I guess they were. 82, 80, 81 games, all up there over 16, 15 points a game. Come on. This was an incredible group of guys, and we may never see that again because of the era of the specialists. You can't compare then with now. It's a different game, as I said, outside in opposed to inside out. Different kind of player, different kind of athlete. Better athlete today, bigger, faster, stronger. But are they more intelligent? I question that. And that was the difference. That's how you cut the herd. That inconsistency. So matching errors can't do it. But matching talent, because of what you accomplish, yeah, you can.
Yeah. I want to know a little more about one of those players. Most Bucks fans will be able to rattle off the names, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Oscar Robertson, Bobby Dandridge, John McLaughlin. But you mentioned Greg Smith, and that's one name that keeps coming up as I go through these game-by-game recaps, which, to your point, it's funny, at the end of the year, they're resting their starters, and they play like 39, 40 minutes a game, and it's like that's rest for them, yeah. Which is funny. But Greg Smith hit a lot of big shots. He had some major, major moments, and I realize it's probably because there were superstars in other spots on the court. That's bound to be the case. But tell me what you remember from him. That was his last year in Milwaukee, and it seems like he was a huge contributor along the way.
That was a big piece that was removed that might have allowed us to win the title a couple more times during that period of time between the beginning of the franchise, or the second year when we really took off, and through the 74 season. He was a big, big contributor. Another fellow, 82 games. Greg Smith. He didn't shoot the ball as well as maybe some of the others. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm going back in my mind again. I know he was over 51% from the floor, but he didn't get as many shots as the other fellows because he was kind of like the pickup guy. Anything around the basket, he'd pick it up. And he could jump. I mean, he had pogo sticks built in those legs. I mean, they were unbelievable how he would get up off the ground for a guy 6'5". Now remember, 6'5", 6'6", he and Bob Dandridge starting forwards. Is that incredible? And he is a guy that averaged about 12 points a game that season. And I would tell you this, an incredible mid-range inside player for a guy 6'5". And we don't see enough of that anymore. We don't see that mid-range jump shot like we used to see. And if you watch a game, you're going to see it's wide open because the guys like to get out there beyond the three-point line. You know, they're constantly playing, you know, outside the city limits. And then they're trying to work the ball. You know, the big guy, you got a guy like Lopez now. Where does he take the majority of his shots? He's going to take his shots outside. He's going to get putback opportunities inside. He's not a guy that's going to get you a lot of opportunities around the basket. Greg Smith at 6'5 could pick up more garbage than the guys collecting in the streets of Milwaukee right now.
That's awesome. The 20-game winning streak you mentioned, it did come at kind of an unusual time. It came at the end of the season, like you mentioned. And toward the end of that, they clinch the division. They really wrap up everything they need as far as playoff positioning goes. And I know that if that had happened today, it would be a really hot topic. Should they go for the winning streak or should they rest for the playoffs? You know, and I'm sure the coach Larry Costello was kind of two minds there. He's trying to get the Bucks ready for the stuff that really matters. At the same time, they're getting 17, 18 wins. They're tying the streak, the previous streak that the Knicks held, 18 consecutive wins. They have a chance to surpass it. That had to be tough. You know, you also want to put a place in history, leave a mark in history if you can. Do you remember that being a hot topic, if it was a tough needle to thread for Costello and for the Bucks, or do you just remember, hey, they had a chance to win, you know, 20 straight games, they were going to go for it?
Yeah, no, I think that they wanted to go for it. I think Larry Costello was a winner. And again, I think that when we talk about this team, we don't talk too much or hear too much about Larry Costello. Remember now, he was the architect that put together the offense that brought two players, the greatest players of all time, which could have been a clash, but it never was, because they knew that they had each other. And that's the reason why Oscar came to Milwaukee, and Kareem just relished the thought of having Oscar Robertson, who was somebody he idolized, with him on the same team. So it was all about winning, winning, winning. And I think that Larry Costello looked at it that way. He really did. And he said, we win. We're going to go for it. And I think that maybe there might have been one or two times when they gave some consideration to maybe, you know, resting guys toward the end of a game. But I don't ever recall anything off the top. And again, you know, I'm just kind of recalling what I can, where they said, well, we're going to rest somebody here today. And that wasn't there. I mean, they wanted to put a message out there that they were ready to steamroll, which they did in the playoffs. People were really aware of the fact that this team took no prisoners, and that was what it was all about. So that was the impression that I always had. You know, there were certain areas that the broadcast that you could get into, and there certain areas you couldn't. Larry was very, very much protective of the things that he let out to the media, even back then. And as well as I knew him, and you know, I just, there was certain ground that I didn't want to get involved with, and so I just kind of stayed away from some things and let him share with me most of the time what he wanted. Now, if it came to player decisions on a game to game because of injury or this and that, we would always go over stuff on his pregame show. But there were certain things I knew he wanted to be protective, because he was very aware, thinking maybe the other team would use it as ammunition against us. So, no, he just went out there with the idea, hey, we're gonna take you to the task, and this is what it's going to be, and I'm going to put my best guns out there, and that's the way it's going to be.
It's interesting you say that, because going through the game by game, I'm struck differently, not necessarily by Larry Costello, but you got some characters that are head coaches, like Bill Van Bredekhoff with Detroit, or Bill Fitch with Cleveland. Like, these guys are saying very funny things, very candid things that would not be, Bob Cousy, would not be said today by NBA coaches. So it's interesting that Larry Costello kept things more close to the vest, because it strikes me it was a different time and people felt a little more free to say what was on their mind.
No, absolutely. Larry, at that point in time, was well aware of the fact that he had these two great players. Of course, he played against Oscar, so he knew how great he was. And he was trying to prove his mettle as a coach, too. And he wanted to make sure that this team would go down in history as one of the all-time greats. And if you go through if you went back and looked at the record on a day-by-day basis as to where this team came and look, where they started their 20-game winning streak, I think we started, somewhere around February, and then watched that thing grow, because this season, don't forget, back then we finished the regular season in March and the playoffs in April. It's a whole lot different than it is now. So we squeezed things. The season started a week or so earlier, but the schedule was squashed together a lot more than it is now. I mean, they do as much as they can to give these players a break today, as opposed to then. It was, come on, boys, get on the bus. We're ready to go. So, yeah, Larry, unlike some of the other coaches, he was less media-oriented than some of the guys that seize the media as an opportunity to build their own brand. Larry wasn't really interested in that. He was interested in basketball. He was a basketball guy. Oh, I remember one situation where we were out having dinner one night, myself and Larry and our team physician, who was an owner, George Corkus, and we had just lost an exhibition game to the Portland Trailblazers the first year that Bill Walton was in the league. We're playing in Dayton, Ohio, and we lost the game. And this was the first meeting of Kareem against Bill Walton professionally. And we all were kind of hungry after the game, as we always were. So we were looking for a restaurant. There was no place to go in Dayton because they had a thing called the Blue Laws, except one place. There was a pizza place located in Dayton. We found out about it, so everybody kind of got the word, and we went over there to get something to eat. Well, so did Portland. And when we looked up, we're sitting at the table, Larry, myself, and the team physician, and Larry saw Bill Walton and Kareem walking in together and talking. He went bananas because he thought, this can't be. We just lost a game to these guys. Well, it's exhibition season, Larry. No, that doesn't mean a thing. No, we got to beat these guys. We got to show them who we are. And he went on and on. He's getting louder and louder. And finally, our team physician, who was quite a character unto himself, George Corkus, he leaned over and he says, Larry, my friend, he said, you know, I'm a little concerned about you. He said, I'm afraid if they open up your brain, 1,000 little basketballs would fall out on the table. And that was Larry. That was Larry. That was his life. He was all about the game, about putting something together to beat the other guy and to win. And that's why when we lost Kareem to L.A., that next season was too much of a challenge for Larry. He'd been used to winning, and, you know, he kind of packed it all in shortly into the season when we were trying to build a green and growing Bucks.
Yeah. The speaking of Kareem, he's a New York guy. You mentioned that earlier, and I imagine fueled his fire a little bit when talking about the Bucks' battles with the New York Knicks. The Knicks had Milwaukee's number. They'd eliminated them from the previous playoffs. I believe they got them 4 out of 5 times or 4 out of 6 times during the regular season. So everyone's anticipating that this is going to be that matchup. And I think the Bucks, it seems like they got a few breaks. First of all, they got a Lakers team with Jerry West had been lost for the year with an Achilles injury late in the season. Elgin Baylor had been lost way at the beginning of the year. The Lakers were not at full strength. So the Bucks got past them pretty easily. And then they're waiting for whether it's going to be Baltimore or the Knicks. That series goes 7 games, and Baltimore wins it. I know a lot of the players at the time said they wanted to play the Knicks. I'm sure fans were excited about that possibility. But on the other hand, Baltimore is an easier opportunity, you know, like perceivably an easier opportunity. Do you think the players really were disappointed by that? Or was it just, let's get this championship and not worry about the circumstances? I mean, how did the players look at that when Baltimore upset New York?
Well, I would tell you, and again, going back on my memory on this one a little bit, New York had the number on us during the regular season. They were they beat us 4 out of 5 games. So maybe there's a little of that, well, let's get even with these guys and do the number on them in the playoffs. And so when Baltimore went in there and beat up on the Knicks, they got beat up themselves. So when they got to us, there wasn't much left, and we really took advantage of that and just swooped right through that series. So we'll never know how that might have turned out because, you know, the Knicks had their greatest teams during that time. You know, they won 2 championships during that run the year before we won, and then they came back again, I think, in 73 and won. And so that was a question that was bandied about quite a bit at the time, to be honest with you. What would Milwaukee do against New York if they got them in the finals and they were able to take care of business? And that was the end of that. You know, the Knicks, they had the number and they were looking forward to playing us, and maybe they looked past Baltimore, who had a good team with some very good players. But when they got beat by Baltimore, Baltimore came to us, and they were out of gas. They had a tough series, and when we got to them, it was kind of like easy pickings.
Yeah, and I that series is, you know, you'd like to point to one or two highlights or whatever from the NBA Finals, but there just weren't any. The Bucks dominated, and I know that. It sounds like Oscar Robertson played his best game in Game 4, the one that clinched things up in that four-game sweep. It sounds like Robertson was really excited to be in this position, having spent so many years at Cincinnati, you know, getting that first title. Eyewitnesses will tell you that Robertson was kind of a man possessed there toward the very end when they beat Baltimore. Is that what you remember as well, that became Oscar's, you know, Oscar's team for that final stretch of games?
Yes, this was Oscar's team. Oscar wanted more than anything in his career, because remember when Oscar came into the game, you know, statistics were kind of sloppy, and people really weren't able to really see the real Oscar Robertson. For those that would sit down, the figure Filberts, and sit down and really understand, you know, what the player is doing today, figures and numbers and stats, that's all you see. It's overdone. Back then it was underdone. So for Oscar Robertson to really prove to people who follow the game of basketball about what a quality player he was, because he was not only just a talent, he was a smart talent. And this was his opportunity to leave his stamp. His legacy was going to be left by what he did when he was in Milwaukee, not by what people heard he did when he was in Cincinnati. So, yes, this was his series, and I think everybody was equally as happy for Oscar Robertson as they were for the Bucks at that championship.
What they win this championship, there's no parade. It's very different than it would be today. There isn't a lot of aftermath to it. And I mean, I guess I could speak a little bit to Milwaukee just not maybe being all in yet as a city. Obviously there are plenty of Bucks fans in town at this point, but what was up with that? Why was there was there an absence of buzz, or is that just something we perceive? We don't really understand how big of a deal this was.
Well, again, radio, TV, back in those days, the game was on delayed broadcast, so you weren't getting it straight hand. So people had to wait until the next morning, basically, to get up and find out how the team did if they didn't stay up late and watch the game. There was a little bit of a gathering, and I'm responsible for some of that, because I remember getting on the radio and exhorting the then-mayor, Henry Meyer, to put down his pipe and grab a car and come on out to the airport with a bunch of people and greet this team. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I was a little full of myself at that point in time, euphoric over the win. But, you know, I stepped forward and said, you got a little husky with the mayor there, you know, and he responded. He came out. He came out to the airport, and I would say there were probably 2,500 people there when we got there. That was it. And there was no parade to follow things up. No, it was pretty much what we did on our own. I think we had a little bit of a gathering, and then we went off into our own groups and enjoyed the fruits of everybody's labor. But unlike today, where it becomes a media event, and of course seized by the media so they could go out and sell commercial time, this was an opportunity for them to fatten their calves as well. So, you know, times have changed. What can I tell you? Times have changed. But the ball is still played on 94 feet of maple, and you still have to put it in. You got to fill the funnel in order to win the game. So where are we going here with this? With people trying to compare that era with this? Yeah, you can if you really want to start to get in off some of the things on the side, but basketball is basketball. It's a beautiful game. It is an art form, as Kareem would tell you. And the people that really work at it to become professionals deserve their due.
It's kind of ironic that if there were a celebration, I'm sure the Summerfest grounds named for Henry Meyer would be involved in some way, shape, or form. There would probably be some celebration on the lakefront. So that's kind of funny. The year after, 1972, when we talked last time, you had said that the Bucks really, 1974, when they get back to the NBA Finals, was a real heartbreak for them. They had a Game 7 in Milwaukee. They just couldn't seal the deal with the Celtics. You had said that Oscar Robertson had confided that he really felt like the Bucks could have won three titles during his fairly brief tenure in Milwaukee, and he's probably right. What went wrong in 72? The team is obviously still very good. The principal characters are all still there, but Bob Boozer has retired. Dick Cunningham and Greg Smith have been traded. I don't know if that made that big a difference. The Lakers, when they met the Bucks in the playoffs, they had Jerry West at full strength. They had, I think Jim McMillan had gotten really good that year. They still had Wilt Chamberlain. So they were a tough team, but the Bucks had kind of handled them in 1971. So what happened in 72, and was that as big a disappointment as it looks like on paper?
Big disappointment. Big disappointment. We won 63 games that year and finished number one in the division and all that. We go out and get beat by San Francisco. That was not good, and the team did not play well, and there were certain individuals that didn't play that well. But I think you can go back and start to what I said before by taking Greg Smith, Dick Cunningham, trading them, and Bob Boozer retiring. You put a hole in the core group of players, because back then you had an eight-man rotation, basically. You didn't have 15 guys, where today you've got 15 with a couple of guys on the G League team that beat the road, Highway 45 on the way up to Oshkosh or wherever the heck it, I can't remember the highway.
Sure, 41, yes.
41, well, I'm close. anyway, but, you know, you got enough guys on that bench now, and half of them are guarding the Gatorade. But, you know, you're trying to get 10, 12 guys a game in there. That wasn't a problem back then. You played eight guys. When you got to the playoffs, you had your basic eight. So you're taking Cunningham, Smith, who was a starter, Cunningham, who gave Kareem 10 minutes a game, or whatever it might have been, and then Bob Boozer, who's your number one sub, and he's just under 10 points a game regular season, and they're gone, and now you're filling it in with a couple of other names that really didn't fill the bill at that time. And you take away not only the core group, but you take away the synergy, how the team synced. And I think it's important to remind people, as I always remind myself, that a winning basketball team is really dependent on complementary parts. You go out there and try and do it alone, you don't do it. We've seen Giannis try that a couple times in the playoffs, and it hasn't worked. It only works when you try and get everybody engaged and everybody knows what they're doing. And here was the value of Oscar Robertson. Oscar Robertson knew everybody's position on the floor, where they should be. So if they were to run a play and somebody was in the wrong position, he would let you know. And he wasn't embarrassed about it. He would let you know, or I shouldn't say bashful about it, the player that he would be looking at, glaring at, would be the one that would be embarrassed. I've seen him do it. He'd hit you right between the eyes in front of 18,000 people, because you were in the wrong place. So it was that system that they had, that syncing up, people understanding where other people should be, being in the right position. Now I want you to think about something here, because this is very important in any sport, really. Like take soccer, for instance, positioning, how important it is. What are you doing when you don't have the ball on your foot? What are you doing when you don't have the ball in your hand? You should be in a position where you can make a play if it comes to you, not standing around stationary and watching. It's a game of movement, fluidity, and, you know, you get in trouble when you don't move. That team that we had at times had lapses, and it just didn't work. And it was unfortunate, and we had to find a way to pull it together, and we did. But it took us until the 73-74 season. And it's unfortunate that it worked that way. But we came close right down to the final game in 74 and should have won that one as well.
Yeah. So before I let you go, let me know, give me a sense of what you're doing now. I know you're out in California and that you get back to Milwaukee on occasion when, you know, there aren't pandemics. I know you're watching a lot of Bucks basketball. What have you been doing to pass the time here?
Well, I, you know, of course, still actively involved as a board member with the Mack Fund, which is the legacy that Johnny Mack and I really leave the city with. And that plus Bango, I mean, he's a big part of it. What the heck, you know? And people see Bango the Buck, they got to know it came from somewhere, and it was Johnny Mack's three-point rainbow jumper back before they had a three-pointer. It was Bango. So I spent a lot of time with the Mack Fund. I spent a lot of time, you know, when possible, with the Basketball Hall of Fame, which I was fortunate enough to win the Gaudy Award a few years back. So that's become a love of mine. And I've been working with Horner Sports Flooring for a number of years. They do the majority of the flooring work with the NBA. You look at their floors now, they've done the All-Star Game floor for 38 years in a row, whatever it is, and all the G League stuff you're seeing, the bubble stuff, that was all Horner. So I've been involved with them. The Badger floor is a Horner floor. The Marquette floor is a Horner floor. So, you know, with all of that, plus my grandkids, you know, I've been filling the time up pretty good. The pandemic has really hurt a guy like me because I like to keep it in the high gear. And so I've had to put it back into neutral a little bit, and I'm looking forward to the day when we can rip off the masks, start living normally, and I can throw this into another gear and get rolling, God willing.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Any last stories or any last tidbits, thoughts you have about that 1971 or 70-71 season as we get set to commemorate its 50th anniversary?
Well, I would tell you that there was a lot of camaraderie, as there usually is in happy clubhouses, and I think that we had a group of guys that understood each other, that liked each other, and there was a commonality in the sense they wanted to go out there and win, and they sensed that Oscar was reaching toward the end, and I think every one of those fellows wanted to pitch in and not only get it done for the city and the team, but really for Oscar Robertson, because they knew, being basketball players and studied a little history of the game, what this guy had meant to the game, what he had done for players' rights back in the early days, and where they've come to now, that this was a major, major contributor to the success that they were having in their own game. So it was about Oscar Robertson. We knew Kareem would have greater days, greater years. Fortunately for me, I was able to broadcast almost every one of Kareem's major events, from the time he broke the scoring record to you name it. So this was a special group of guys, and I got a chance to be a kind of eyewitness, ear witness, so to speak, on many of those bus rides and the fun and the laughter that they had. And to this day, when I see them, we always have a few giggles. We really a good bunch of guys. It really was. And you know, Milwaukee, I can't tell you. And this is almost emotional when I get talking about the city and the state, because of the reception and what it meant for me in my career. And the way I saw this team being embraced by the fans in the state and the city was something I will never forget, because it was the greatest time of my professional career, the time that I spent with the Milwaukee Bucks. So, you know, we can talk on and on, and as I talk into the day and into the night, I can come up with thoughts and ideas. But right now, the most important thought that I can come up with was the way the state and the city accepted the Milwaukee Bucks in those great years we had that we just talked about through 1974 playoffs, and what it would have been if we had been able to win a couple more to some of those players. And what would it have been for Kareem? Would he have wanted to stick around and stay longer? I don't know. That's a question that has never been answered.
Yeah, fascinating what if in Wisconsin sports history. He again is Eddie Doucette. He was the voice of the Milwaukee Bucks back in their heyday, 16 seasons on TV and radio. He was recognized in 2013 with the Kurt Gowdy Award by the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. A longtime fan of the Milwaukee Bucks and part of the Milwaukee Bucks community. co-founder of the Mac Fund. Thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to talking to you again. We'll probably have some reason to do this again, right? We've done this now twice in 3 years. We'll do it in two more years. How does that sound?
Well, listen, as long as you keep calling, that means my nostrils are still above water, and that's what So keep calling, baby. That's it.
That sounds great.
All right.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate the time. That's all we've got today. Thanks for tuning in. Looking back at that 1971 Bucks team. Tune in early next week. I'll be chatting again with Jim Ozarski. We'll have a lot to discuss. The Bucks do face off with the Nets on Sunday and Tuesday. They've got the Bulls tonight as you listen to this on Friday night. So that's a game worth noting as well. And we will catch up and look ahead to the playoffs. The season is coming to a close here, and Milwaukee kind of knows roughly what its destination is at this point. So we will have more and look and see where the Giannis injury stands at that point, and we'll figure out what's going on from there. So thanks for tuning in. We will chat with you again real soon. Bye-bye.